A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the art of social trolling and where you go to practice it. His candidate, lunch with distant relatives. The kind of people who share enough DNA to justify a meeting, but so little of your life that they're functionally strangers with a family tree. His question is, what makes that arena so uniquely fertile? And then he wants the actual technique, the step-by-step craft from appetizers through goodbye. How to inject creative flair without crossing into cruelty, how to gauge when the prescribed civility is about to crack, and how to bid farewell in a way that lingers. He's asking for the masterclass.
And the answer starts with the paradox of the distant relative. They're bound by obligation, but not intimacy. You share enough history to justify sitting at the same table, but not enough to predict their conversational reflexes. That's the first thing that makes this arena special. It's a controlled environment with real stakes.
Unlike strangers, they can't just walk away without a story to tell about why.
And unlike close family, they don't know your tells. Your siblings know when you're winding them up. Your parents can read your voice from across the house. But a second cousin you see once every 3 years, they're flying blind. That asymmetry is the whole game.
So the distant relative lunch is a pressure vessel with a gauge you can watch. Defined structure, appetizers, main course, goodbye, limited time window, and a social contract strong enough to hold but thin enough to test.
And the key word in Daniel's prompt is creative flair. He's not asking how to be cruel. He's drawing a line between trolling as vandalism and trolling as craft. The distant relative lunch is a canvas, not a demolition site. If they leave feeling attacked, you failed. If they leave thinking, you've made art.
The failure mode of bad social trolling is being remembered as the cousin who ruined lunch. The success condition is being remembered as the one who asked that strange question.
So let's map this chronologically, because the structure of the meal is the structure of the operation. Appetizers first.
Before you control, you have to calibrate.
The first 10 minutes are pure reconnaissance. You're not injecting anything yet. You're establishing the baseline. What are their conversational defaults? Do they lead with career updates, complaints about politics, family gossip? The relative who immediately asks what you do for work is telling you that status signaling is their comfort zone. The one who opens with a complaint about the drive or the parking is telling you that shared grievance is their social currency.
And the one who leads with how busy they've been is telling you they want credit for showing up.
That's a good read. You're also watching for their tempo. Some people speak in paragraphs, some in sentences. Some pause for reactions, some barrel through. The calibration phase is about matching their rhythm closely enough that you don't register as a foreign presence. You want to feel familiar, even if you're not.
I'd add one thing here. In the first 10 minutes, you're also establishing your own baseline in their minds. You want them to form a quick, comfortable impression of you. Agreeable, interested, slightly bland. That's the version of you they'll compare everything else against later.
That's the setup for the first real technique Daniel's asking about. The pointed question. And the specific mechanism I'd recommend is something I think of as asymmetric disclosure.
Break that down.
You share something mildly personal or controversial about yourself first. Not a confession, not trauma dumping. Something that signals you're willing to be a little more candid than the occasion strictly calls for. This creates an implicit invitation. The psychology is well documented. When someone discloses, the recipient feels reciprocal pressure to match the level of candor. You've opened a door, and the social script nudges them through it.
Give me the actual words.
All right. You've been talking for 15 minutes. The appetizers are on the table. The mood is polite but shallow. You say something like, I've been reading about how family dynamics change when people stop pretending to agree on everything. It's made me wonder, do you think our family has unspoken rules about what we're allowed to say at these lunches?
That's good. You haven't accused anyone of anything. You framed it as a genuine curiosity about the family as a system. But you've also named the elephant in the room, the fact that everyone is performing.
And the beauty of that question is it works no matter how they answer. If they deflect with a joke, you've learned they're uncomfortable with meta conversation. If they engage thoughtfully, you've found a genuine opening. If they get defensive, you've mapped the boundary without crossing it.
The question does the work regardless.
That's the test of a good pointed question. It should be a probe, not a weapon. It gathers information even when it doesn't land.
Now Daniel also asked about pushing back on a political position. That's a higher risk move. How do you do that without the lunch becoming a headline?
The technique here is to push back on a minor premise, not the core belief. If a relative says, "The problem with this country is that nobody wants to work anymore," you don't say you're wrong. You don't even say, "I disagree." You say something like, "I've heard that argument a lot, but I've also seen data that suggests labor participation has actually been rising in certain sectors. I'm curious what's shaping your view on that."
You've disagreed without disagreeing. You've asked them to show their work.
And you've done it without making yourself the opponent. The question, "What's shaping your view?" reframes the exchange as mutual curiosity rather than debate. If they answer substantively, you've opened a real conversation. If they get flustered, you've learned exactly where the civility membrane is.
Default pause.
That's the signal. When a relative stops eating and holds their fork in midair, they're processing discomfort. It's a documented microexpression in dining settings. A pause in eating signals cognitive load, not just politeness. The fork hovers because the brain is busy.
I've seen that exact pause. It's the moment where the social script glitches.
And that's your boundary indicator. When you see the fork pause, you've hit the limit of prescribed civility for that particular topic with that particular relative. You don't push further. You note the boundary and you either change the subject or you ease back to safer ground. The craft is in reading the signal, not in ignoring it.
This brings us to what I think is the structural advantage of the distant relative lunch, the obligation trap.
Right. Distant relatives can't easily leave. A stranger at a party can drift toward the bar. A coworker can suddenly remember a meeting. But a second cousin at a family lunch is socially trapped. They're not going to stand up, throw down their napkin, and walk out over a slightly uncomfortable question.
Not without becoming the story.
Not without becoming the story everyone tells at the next family gathering. So they stay. And that gives you a wider operating window than you'd have with anyone else. But, and this is the crucial part, the obligation cuts both ways. You're trapped too. If you push too hard and they crack, you're the one who made lunch unbearable, and you're the one who has to sit there through dessert while everyone pretends nothing happened.
Mutual, assured discomfort.
The craft is in recognizing the mutual constraint. You're both in the same container. Your job isn't to break it. It's to press on the walls just enough to feel them flex.
All right. Appetizers are done. We've calibrated. We've tested the boundaries. Now we're into the main course. What changes?
The main course is where you can introduce what I'd call layered provocation. You introduce a second, slightly more charged topic while the first is still simmering. This creates cognitive load. The relative now has to manage two conversational threads, one of which is unresolved, and that makes it harder to maintain scripted responses.
Give me a concrete sequence.
Let's say the appetizer phase ended with your political pushback still hanging in the air. They gave a half answer, the fork paused, you backed off. Now, during the main course, you pivot to something that seems unrelated but is actually adjacent. Speaking of how things change, I heard the weirdest thing about Great Uncle Morris and the property in Vermont. Did that ever get resolved?
You've introduced a family rumor while the political tension is still cooling. Now they're juggling.
And the family rumor has its own gravity. It's personal, it's specific, and it's the kind of thing distant relatives often have partial information about. They might know something you don't. They might have a strong opinion they've been waiting to share. Either way, you've moved the conversation from abstract disagreement to concrete family narrative, and that shift changes the emotional register.
It also reframes you. You're no longer the cousin who asked an uncomfortable question about politics. You're the cousin who knows family history and is interested in piecing it together.
That reframing is essential. The goal of layered provocation isn't to accumulate discomfort, it's to keep the conversation dynamic enough that no single thread defines the lunch. By the time dessert arrives, they've had four or five different kinds of conversation with you, and they can't easily summarize the experience. That ambiguity is the mark of successful social trolling.
They can't reduce you to a simple story.
Which means the story they tell later will be more interesting. We had lunch with corn. He asked the strangest question about family rules, and then we got into this whole thing about Great Uncle Morris, and I'm still not sure what he thought about the election. That's a much better outcome than we had lunch with Corn, and he argued about politics.
Now we arrive at the goodbye. Daniel specifically asked about bidding farewell, whether fond or otherwise. What's the technique?
This is where I'd use what I call the unresolved echo. You end the conversation on a note that lingers. Not a fight, not a resolution, not a summary. A question or an observation that reframes the entire lunch as something other than what they thought it was.
Words, please.
You're standing by the car, coats on, the check is paid. You say, I've really enjoyed this. It's made me wonder what our grandparents would think about how different we all are now.
That's elegant. You haven't accused anyone of anything. You haven't declared a winner. You've reframed the entire lunch as an experiment in family evolution. And you've planted a question they'll think about on the drive home.
That's the echo. It's not a closing statement. It's an opening they carry with them. The lunch doesn't end when you stop talking. It ends when they stop thinking about it.
And the alternative? The goodbye that isn't fond?
If the lunch went sideways, if you misread a boundary and things got genuinely tense, the technique is different. You don't try to salvage it with an unresolved echo. That reads as glib. Instead, you do something counterintuitive. You thank them specifically for something real. I appreciated what you said about your work situation. That gave me something to think about. You're signaling that even in the friction, you found value. That's disarming in a way that apology often isn't.
Because apology admits fault and closes the book. Gratitude leaves it open.
And it's harder to stay angry at someone who just thanked you sincerely.
Let's pull back for a second. What's the knock-on effect of all this? What happens after the lunch?
The distant relative now has a story to tell about you. And the quality of that story is the measure of your craft. If the story is, my cousin argued with me about politics, you've done mediocre work. If the story is, my cousin asked me this strange question about family rules, and I'm still not sure what he was getting at, you've done good work. If the story is, I had lunch with my cousin, and I've been thinking about it for 3 days, you've done exceptional work.
You've become memorable, but not for the discomfort, for the experience.
That's the distinction between art and vandalism. Vandalism leaves a mark the target wants to erase. Art leaves a mark the target chooses to keep.
And the ethical boundary Daniel's prompt is careful about. Where is it exactly?
The boundary is impact. If the relative leaves feeling hurt, diminished, or attacked, you've failed as a practitioner. The craft isn't about winning. It's about creating an experience that's more interesting than the default polite lunch. The target should leave thinking, not bleeding.
There's also a practical boundary. If you're too aggressive, you don't get invited back. And the distant relative lunch is a renewable resource only if you maintain access.
That's the long game. A single memorable lunch is good. A reputation as the interesting cousin who asks strange questions is better. A reputation as the cousin nobody wants to sit next to is failure.
What about the risk that you're not the only one playing?
That's the multiplayer problem. And it's the thing most practitioners overlook. You assume you're the agent and everyone else is the audience. But what if your second cousin also read the same playbook? What if they're sitting across from you, running their own calibration phase, deploying their own asymmetric disclosures?
Then the lunch becomes a hall of mirrors.
And the person who loses is the one who doesn't realize it's a multiplayer game. If you're running your techniques and they're running theirs, and neither of you knows the other is playing, the conversation becomes strange in ways neither of you can quite name. You both leave unsettled, each thinking the other was oddly probing.
That's almost funnier than winning.
It's the social trolling equivalent of mutually assured destruction. Two practitioners, each thinking they're the only one with a plan, both deploying unresolved echoes at the goodbye. They spend the next week thinking about each other's questions and never know why.
The distant relative lunch is an arms race. Nobody admits they're in.
And that brings us to something Daniel's prompt implies but doesn't state directly. Why practice this at all? What's the point of getting good at lunch with distant relatives?
Because it's the lowest stakes arena with real constraints. You can't practice social engineering on strangers. There's no container, no obligation. They just leave. You can't practice on close family. They know you too well, and the emotional stakes are too high. The distant relative lunch is the sweet spot. Real enough to matter, distant enough to risk.
It's the flight simulator of social trolling. You're in a cockpit with real instruments, but if you crash, the damage is contained.
and the skills transfer. Reading microexpressions, calibrating disclosure, managing cognitive load, deploying unresolved echoes. Those work in boardrooms, in negotiations, in any situation where you need to shape an interaction without appearing to shape it.
The distant relative lunch is the dojo. You train there so that when it matters, the techniques are reflex.
I want to add one thing about the goodbye that we haven't covered. The goodbye is also where you plant the seed for the next lunch. If you've done this well, they'll want to see you again. Not because you were agreeable, but because you were interesting. The best goodbye makes them curious about what you'll ask next time.
That's the long-term craft. You're building a relationship that's more engaging than the default. And that's the part that separates this from mere trolling. You're not extracting entertainment at their expense. You're upgrading the interaction for both of you.
The distant relative who used to be a chore becomes someone you're curious about.
And that curiosity is real, even if it started as practice. That's the strange alchemy of this whole thing. You begin by treating them as a canvas, and somewhere in the process, the canvas becomes a person you're actually interested in.
Because you've asked questions nobody else asked them.
Because you've been paying attention in a way that polite conversation doesn't require. You've been reading their fork pauses, tracking their conversational defaults, probing the boundaries of what they're comfortable discussing. That's a kind of attention most people never receive from anyone.
All right. So we've mapped the meal. Appetizers are calibration and asymmetric disclosure. The main course is layered provocation and cognitive load management. The goodbye is the unresolved echo, a question that reframes the lunch and lingers on the drive home.
And the through line is reading the signals. The fork pause, the eye movement to the exit, the sudden interest in the menu. These tell you how much pressure the container can hold. The craft isn't in pushing harder, it's in pushing precisely.
The distant relative lunch as precision instrument.
The distant relative lunch as art form.
I mediated a family inheritance dispute in 1994. Three distant cousins. Their grandfather's will required them to have lunch together once a month for 2 years, or the estate went to a cat charity. I sat at a nearby table and took notes.
Wait.
The grandfather was a piece of work. He'd been estranged from all three branches of the family for decades. The will was his last move. He wanted to see if they'd tear each other apart or figure it out.
What happened?
One of them, the youngest, maybe 26, thought he was being clever. Pointed questions, little provocations, the whole thing. He'd read some book about conversational dominance. He spent 6 months thinking he was running circles around the other two.
He wasn't.
The other two cousins were siblings. They'd grown up together. They'd been reading each other's tells since they were children. They knew within two lunches exactly what he was doing, and they decided to let him keep thinking he was in control.
They played along.
For 6 months. Every lunch, they gave him just enough reaction to keep him confident. The fork pauses, the deflections, all performed. He never caught on.
What happened at the end?
Month 7, they stopped forming. Just stopped. Went completely flat. Answered his questions with one word. No eye contact, no reaction. He spent the next 5 lunches trying to get the game back, and they gave him nothing.
They reverse trolled him.
He quit the lunches. Forfeited his share of the inheritance. The siblings got everything. And I'm fairly sure the grandfather would have approved.
He was trolling them from beyond the grave.
The will was the first move. The lunches were the game, and none of them ever figured out that the real opponent was the man who wrote the rules.
So the lesson is, know whether you're the only one playing.
The lesson is that the person who thinks they're the smartest one at the table usually isn't. The cousins who won weren't the ones with the technique. They were the ones with the patience.
They waited.
6 months of lunches. They could have confronted him. They could have stopped coming. Instead, they just watched. And when they were ready, they took the game away from him without saying a word.
That's a darker version of what we've been describing.
It's the same version. You said the craft is about reading signals. The cousin who lost wasn't reading signals. He was so focused on his own performance that he never noticed the other two were performing back. The fork pauses he thought he was causing? They were timing them.
That's unsettling.
The grandfather's will had a clause, paragraph 14. Said the lunches had to be conducted in good faith with genuine effort toward familial reconciliation. The siblings argued that the youngest cousin's behavior violated that clause. They had 6 months of notes. I had 6 months of notes. The estate's lawyer agreed.
So he lost the inheritance because he was bad at social trolling.
He lost the inheritance because he was obvious about it. The siblings were better, and they never wrote a book about conversational dominance. They just paid attention.
What happened to them after?
They sold the grandfather's house, split the money, and I think they still have lunch once a month. Not because anyone's making them.
The practice became real.
The practice was always real. That's the thing the youngest cousin never understood. He thought it was a game he was playing on them. They understood it was a game they were all in together. The only question was, who knew the rules?
And the grandfather.
Died in 1989. Never saw any of it. But he'd been a corporate mediator for 40 years. He knew exactly what he was setting in motion. The will was his last case.
That's a man who understood the long game.
The cat charity got a mention in the will as the alternate beneficiary. I looked them up once. They never knew they were almost very rich.
The cutting room floor detail I keep coming back to is that the Fort Paws is actually studied. There's a body of work on dining micro-expressions. Researchers have found that people pause their eating when cognitive load spikes because the brain diverts resources from motor routines to social processing. It's not just a metaphor. The fork really does hover.
Which makes it a genuine diagnostic tool, not just a colorful way of describing discomfort. The body doesn't lie as well as the face does.
So where does this leave us? If the distant relative lunch is a training ground, and more people get trained, what happens when everyone at the table knows the techniques?
Then the craft evolves. The techniques we've described, asymmetric disclosure, layered provocation, the unresolved echo, they work because they're unexpected. Once they become expected, the game shifts to the next level. Who can perform sincerity most convincingly? Who can fake a fork pause?
The Hall of Mirrors we described.
And that's already happening in a way. As family structures become more fragmented and these lunches become rarer, the people who still have them are often the ones who are most intentional about family dynamics. They've thought about it. They may have read the same things. The naive practitioner walking into a lunch thinking they're the only one with a plan is increasingly likely to be wrong.
So, the lesson is humility.
The lesson is that the best practitioners are the ones who assume everyone else is also practicing. That's what the cousin in Hilbert's story got wrong. He assumed he was the only artist in the room.
And the art form itself, is it dying? Has these lunches become rarer?
I think it's becoming more concentrated. Fewer opportunities, higher stakes per opportunity. The distant relative lunch used to be a common experience. Now it's almost a specialist activity. Which means the people who do it well are practicing a craft that's becoming more valuable, not less.
A dying form that's worth mastering precisely because it's dying.
Scarcity creates value. The cousin who can turn a mandatory family lunch into something memorable. That person has a skill that most people have never developed and will never encounter. They're not just a good conversationalist. They're a practitioner of a rare art.
This has been My Weird Proms. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for that deeply unsettling cautionary tale.
If you have a prompt you'd like us to tackle, social engineering, family dynamics, or anything else strange enough to be interesting, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Try not to overthink your next family lunch.
Or do. That's kind of the point.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.